It's time for the SwampSwamiSports.com audio podcast.
And it's time to play Let's Make a Deal, NCAA Settlement Version. The spirit of Monty Hall is alive and well this week in college athletics. One of the creators and the original host of television's long-running game show, Let's Make a Deal, Monty Hall passed away in 2017 at the age of 96. Now, the Big Dealer's popular TV game show involved a trading floor of wildly dressed contestants, usually in some type of theme to gain his attention, willing to interact with the host for a chance at prizes. Monty Hall would then present the contestant with one or more decisions as to which prize option to choose. In almost every case, one of the contestants' possible selections involved taking a risk on trading a sure thing, like cash, away for an unknown prize behind a numbered curtain or box on the stage floor. And sometimes the contestant taking a numbered curtain won a more valuable prize, like a major appliance. And other times they received a zonk. That was Let's Make a Deal's way of presenting a silly, worthless joke prize like a giant tricycle or a baby goat. You get the idea. Well, what does that game show have to do with college sports? Plenty. On Thursday night, the NCAA, the overlords for most of college athletics,
I'm all in.
And a group of the largest athletic conferences in America agreed to accept a massive $2.8 billion settlement agreement in a pending lawsuit. Now, this agreement will hopefully resolve a class action lawsuit claiming theoretical back pay due for about 14,000 former and current college athletes going all the way back to the year 2016. If you calculate it out on average, that works out to be about $200,000 per athlete. That's not bad. But what caused the lawsuit? A former Arizona State University swimmer by the name of Grant House filed the suit demanding that college athletes under the NCAA's quite confusing name, image, and likeness mandate should have started receiving their share of NIL loot while implementation was being delayed for several years. Now, the attorneys involved in announcing Thursday night's big settlement agreement have been working for months to hammer out a mutually agreeable financial arrangement. So why didn't the NCAA just say, tough luck, we'll see you in court? Woo! And though I'm not an attorney, the consensus was that the NCAA may have been on the hook for as much as $20 billion worth of damages if the lawsuit was permitted to continue on for years and then the NCAA lost in a worst-case scenario. And just like most legal actions, the brave attorneys on both sides come out of the chute barking loudly at each other just to make their clients happy while they're paying the legal fees. And a few months later, both sides then get the bills and become painfully aware of the mounting legal cost and realize that everyone, including the attorneys, might be better off taking a less risky, mutually agreeable deal today rather than spending years in the courts. So if the NCAA eventually lost a $20 billion judgment, it would have resulted in bankruptcy for the organization. But then again, who cares if the NCAA goes under?
Not so fast!
The NCAA, which lists itself as a nonprofit organization, has its primary offices and about 500 employees in Indianapolis, Indiana. One of the NCAA's primary jobs is to conduct championship events for all of college athletics, at a profit, of course. But there is one lone exception. That's the quite lucrative Division I college football playoffs. The BCS football schools keep that revenue themselves and then split the net profits outside of the purview of the NCAA. But in total, the NCAA is comprised of about 1,100 member institutions. According to their own website, 350 schools are considered to be part of the upper division, Division I. Another 310 institutions make up Division II, and 438 colleges participate in Division III sports. With annual revenues of approximately $1 billion per year, the NCAA then takes and redistributes about 60% of their loot back to the member institutions. The remainder is used to keep other programs going and, of course, their own cost of administration. The bulk of the NCAA's income is derived from their ownership of the annual March Madness college basketball tournament for both men and women. The television money, like in most sports for the events, has skyrocketed in the last decade. The NCAA is also keenly aware that the top 60 or so major colleges in today's four largest conferences, those being the SEC, the Big Ten, Big 12, and ACC, have been making some comments about potentially leaving the NCAA and their thick, burdensome, and poorly enforced rulebook. If those remaining big conferences should decide to skedaddle and form their own association, the NCAA's remaining member schools, though numerous, simply don't generate enough money into the coffers to sustain the organization's current size and structure. Now, who's going to pay for this big, newly confirmed $2.8 billion settlement agreement? Number one, the NCAA itself is going to pay $1.1 billion. Now, that'll come out of future revenues over the next 10-year period. The second major payer will be the major conferences, those being the SEC, Big Ten, Big 12, ACC, and believe it or not, the Pac-12. The Pac-12 was included because the lawsuit covered money owed back in 2016. Now that amounts to $664 million to be paid over 10 years. The final amount comes from the other 27 NCAA Division I conferences to the tune of $990 million over the next 10 years. That means there'll be 10 years of payments that become payable in the fall of 2025. In return for this boatload of future money, these plaintiffs have agreed to drop the lawsuit. On the surface, it would appear that every party in the settlement is going to pay a significant portion of this go-away money to end the lawsuit, and that's where the problems are going to begin. If the major conference schools, which receive a significant incremental cash input from the college football playoffs, are the schools which are primarily paying the majority of the NIL money to college athletes, why shouldn't they be the ones picking up the majority of the settlement money? And that's exactly what the other 27 small conferences are asking today. Apparently, the smaller athletic conferences were either not represented or underrepresented at the settlement bargaining table when the framework for this current offer was being put together. The majority of these small conferences, like the rest of us, have only been hearing some details recently about this deal. This all seems a bit shady. Why would the NCAA and the big conferences keep them out? The smaller conferences were apparently being represented by the NCAA itself. Since these schools receive a portion of the NCAA's redistributed financial pie every year, they were probably not perceived as a very serious threat to jump ship and leave the NCAA organization, well, at least not yet. Now remember, the percentage of the NCAA's total revenues derived from these smaller conferences simply does not match up to those coming in from the Big Four conferences. The NCAA is also playing friendly with the big names in college sports because that group of schools has the most financial motivation and wherewithal to leave the organization at some point soon. Here's another question. Doesn't the NCAA understand that many of these smaller athletic school budgets cannot absorb a significant loss in revenue? The NCAA may have been quite aware that member schools playing in these smaller athletic conferences did not have the market power or the financial resources to derail a massive financial settlement like this one. With representation for those 1,000-plus schools effectively locked out of the negotiation room, the NCAA appears to have been more concerned about its own self-preservation rather than allowing its largest group of member institutions to be steamrolled in this settlement. The smaller schools are going to feel a double whammy. The NCAA's portion, the $1.1 billion payment over 10 years, equates to $110 million a year. And as we said earlier, the NCAA's annual revenue is about $1 billion a year. Once the NCAA writes that annual settlement check starting next year in 2025, there's going to be 10% less money available to redistribute back to the member institutions. It normally pays 60% of its revenues back to the member schools. So now let's watch and see if the NCAA takes some of their own medicine and scales back their own operations. Don't be surprised to find that the NCAA funds themselves first out of the remaining annual revenues and things go on as normal. And then there's that $990 million portion of the settlement over 10 years, which is going to be due from each of these non-major conference Division I schools. That amounts to about $99 million per year for the entire group. Now, each of those smaller schools is going to feel some type of impact, though, in their athletic budget to cover the payment. Since many of the small conference schools are already struggling to remain financially viable, any significant loss of revenue beginning in the fall of 2025 is going to have a higher impact on them. I think that there will be a growing number of financially struggling colleges which are going to reduce their future travel expenses by realigning and playing in conferences which make more geographic sense. And many of us fans would prefer to see those renewals of old rivalries with teams in the same geographic area. That actually might be a plus. In some cases, though, the loss of some funding might mean a reduction in the number of competitive sports being offered at some of these smaller schools as well. Now it's time to play the new Let's Make a Deal NCAA settlement version. Now, door number one, the curtain in front of door number one is labeled Fight the Lawsuit. That's right, if the NCAA decided to fight the lawsuit in the courts over a period of years and prevailed in the case, the current college athletic structure would be saved, except for the millions of dollars lost in legal bills. No! If the NCAA ultimately loses the case, though, the current college athletic structure would be zonked and forced to cough up the $20 billion plus the millions in legal costs and head straight to financial oblivion. But before we raise the curtain on door number one to show you what's behind that high-risk strategy, you may prefer to try door number two. Now, door number two is labeled, Quick, let's get this lawsuit settled ASAP. If your legal representatives do not recommend taking the risk in court, the best option was to reduce potential exposure by putting a lot of money onto the table as quickly as possible and hope that the other side prefers their immediate gratification. And that's exactly what the NCAA and large athletic conferences decided to do this week. But before you make a decision between the current two options as they're presented, it might be time for one party to threaten to walk away from either of those two deals. And that means it's door number three, the final curtain. Who walks the plank first? The NCAA has effectively pitted the four remaining large athletic conferences against the 27 smaller conferences on the fairest way to determine and split the cost involved in this settlement agreement. And at the moment, the NCAA appears to have chosen the side of the large conferences, even though the higher percentage of NIL money being paid to athletes was and will remain applicable to the largest schools. Will the smaller conference schools reject the inequity of being kept in the dark about this settlement agreement and then strong-arm to accept the negotiated settlement? Should the smaller conferences threaten to sue the NCAA and then leave en masse? Come back soon as we learn whether the NCAA's smaller conference schools agree to being financially zonked in this settlement agreement. I'm Monty Hall, Swamp Swami.